So welcome everyone to our review of two parshiot, two sections of the Torah, Bereshit from this last Shabbat and Parshat Noach from this upcoming Shabbat. Now obviously it's a big challenge to compact some 2,000 years of history into a 45-minute little class, so we're going to do our best. Just a couple of things to contextualize the evening. First of all, remember that not to get hung up on dates, on time, because time, as we said in Shabbat, is the time of God, not the time of humanity. Clearly, the clock doesn't start until the end of the days of creation, meaning that even the stories that are Adam, Eve, the serpent in the garden, take place on day number 6, which is still part of Bereshit, of the Genesis project. Therefore, they're not historical, they're part of creation. So when we will discover tonight the nature of mankind, it is part and parcel of the creative process. The process doesn't really begin until that fateful 8th day. That's what we spoke about previously. By Yom HaShmini, the 8th day belongs to us. What are you going to do with my world, God says? I've done a good job for 7 days. You rest on the 7th. Okay, Sunday, Yom Rishon, it's yours now. What are you going to make of this world? So when people get hung up on the chronology, the Torah is not a history book. It was never meant as a history book. And this is the famous first Rashi. Rabbi Shlomi Yitzhaki discusses this in the very first verse. What is the nature of the Torah? If it's a book of precepts, then why don't we just go to the first precept, which is the new moon, Rosh Chodesh? Let's just go right there, skip all the stuff. You know, we'll mention the Genesis stuff afterwards. But why get caught up in the, you know, the whole process of, says Rashi, clearly then, it's not a history book, so what is it? Well, it's also a validation of the Jewish right to Israel. And for that, we need to go back to Abraham, and we need to understand how Abraham became Abraham. So tonight, we are going to explore how Abraham became Abraham, because there is a fascinating process that takes 20 generations and some 2,000 years. Abraham, by the way, was born in a very interesting year, 1948. Now, it's very interesting because obviously Israel, it should resonate with everyone. 1948 is Abraham's birth. We know that at age 52, in the year 2000, he is there. He is invited by King Nimrod to join the big project of the Migdal Bavel, of the Tower of Babylon. And Abraham says, no, this is not for me, gentlemen. And he's a young man at the time. He's a youth. This is when he's back in Ur Kasdim. So he's living back there, and he is the world's first iconoclast. I mean, both literally and figuratively. He is smashing idols. Now, how do you get from Abraham? You go from Adam, 10 generations to Noah. Noah is the linchpin, because Noah is the middle of the process. And then from Noah, in Parshat Noah at the end, it gets us from Noah to Abraham, Avram. And what's fascinating, it's a very beautiful thing. I heard this from my teacher. I haven't yet seen this, but they discovered in En Gedi, in Israel, they discovered on the ground, they discovered a mosaic. And it's a very beautiful, beautiful mosaic. And in the mosaic, it has the most boring verses, which come from the end of the Torah, which everyone makes fun of, Book and Chronicles, where it just lists names. I mean, literally names, you know, Adam, Seth, and it goes all the way down, and then it says, Avram, who Avraham? Abram, he is Abraham. And everyone looks at those verses like, what? And yet, if you understand, if you're a thinking person, to go from Adam to Abraham, there is a culling process. We're throwing away a lot of negative genes, a lot of defective DNA has been tossed away. And every generation is only one singular individual who merits to carry the DNA from Adam forward that will eventually become Abraham. So Abraham subsumes all of the previous generations, all of their collective merits, everything that was before comes to Abraham. In fact, there's a beautiful medrash where the angels are making fun of God. They're saying, come on, God, you know, we know the famous question, right? Why did you create man? And the angels are like, oh come on, we don't want, the man's an idiot, look what he's doing. And so they look down at Adam, and he's running around, you know, in the garden and committing his sin. And they say, hey, is that the reason, God? Is this the guy? I says, no, that's not the man. Then you jump weiter, 10 generations, and they see a drunken Noah after the flood. They say, is this the guy? No. And then they get 10 years, generations later, you get to Abraham. God calls the angels over and says, that's the man. He's the reason. All because of Abraham. So these people, in this synagogue, in this mosaic, they got it. They understood that to get from Adam to Noah and the 10 more generations, Avram hu Avraham. This is the validation of a creation itself, Abraham. So Abraham and Sarah are not just our patriarchs, the Avot. If you think about the enormity of what they brought to the world as a whole, and to us specifically, they changed the world in the most major way in history. So it's a very beautiful idea. So it's also negative because people make fun of these two parshas because you have the begats, right? So-and-so begat so-and-so who begat so-and-so. So, you know, all the people who are not into biblical words love to make fun of these parshas because of the famous begats. So let's begin with Genesis. We have a couple of Rashis that I've chosen some hopefully interesting things in Genesis. And then we're going to go right into Noah. Okay, so if you could please turn to your second page where it says class sources. Source number one. I've only put the number 1, 2, 3 by the English translation. Above it is the Hebrew itself. Okay? This following is from my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha. And it's kind of a little bit of a mind-bending question. But let's analyze, okay? So, we'll do the English. God made grow out of the ground every tree that is pleasant to look at and good to eat, including the tree of life, the Eitz HaChayim, in the middle of the garden, B'toch HaGan, and the tree of knowledge, the Eitz HaDas, Ra Tovara, both good and evil. This verse, which is Genesis 2:9, second parak, ninth verse, pasuk tes, it gives us the layout of the magical Gan, of the Garden of Eden. So stop for a second. At this moment, you would say, well, where? What's the location? We would say that the tree of life, the Eitz HaChayim, is betoch. It's in the middle of the garden, the midst of the garden. And we don't really know where the tree of knowledge is. Could be next to it, but we don't know the proximity between the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. Would everyone agree with that statement? It's very simple, right? Nothing tricky here. But then let's look at this fascinating discussion. When the Nachash, the serpent, is attempting to entice Chava, who's all alone. Adam's out somewhere else in the garden, and Eve is there alone. The serpent has her. Now remember, just as a side point, this is not a part of human history. So the story can be, it's not a child's story, you know, the serpent talking to Adam and Eve. It can be understood on many, many levels. And in a Kabbalistic, mystical level, it's very clear what's telling us, right? It's more metaphorical. It's a real story, yes, but what does it mean? What was the serpent? The serpent is the external manifestation of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. Adam and Eve did not have an internalized evil inclination at that point in time. It was external to them. Now, does that mean they couldn't do bad? Well, obviously, I mean, they transgressed the word of God. Clearly, they had an ability to transgress, correct? So what happened? What changed? When they eat from the tree of knowledge, the what had henceforth been external became internalized. So that's why we have an evil inclination that is internalized now, because they took, metaphorically, the fruit, they brought it in, the Yetzer Hara, which was the Nachash, metaphorically, becomes part and parcel of the human condition. That's clear what's going on. So whatever else you want to say, this is clear. It's a part of creation. It's explaining to us how this effect happened. Now, what's the difference then between free choice and what we call good and bad? They're not the same thing. And this is what people really get very confused. Maimonides, Rambam, explains this very clearly. Did Adam and Eve have free choice? Of course they did. They freely ate from the tree of knowledge, transgressing God's word. So they clearly had the choice, right? But what does choice mean at that point? Choice simply means you go to a deli and they hand you a menu and you're like, oh my gosh, boy, that pastrami sounds good, but the smoked turkey, you know, that's also kind of enticing. So you make it's a decision, you make a choice. It doesn't impact your soul, doesn't impact your existence. So clearly they had that ability to choose. They freely chose to listen to the snake. But what happens when the Yetzer Hara, this evil inclination, along with the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, when it becomes part and parcel of the human condition, what changes? So Rambam says what changes. Harishut, license has been given to create for yourself. So Adam and Eve now have an ability to create their own world for themselves. And sometimes, tragically, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmarish vision. I mean, think of a couple, let's say, I'll give you a mashal, a parable, true. A couple of young men are very upset at their classmates, you know, out in Colorado, in a little place called Columbine, and they are whacked out of their minds with anger, and they feel, oh, we're going to take revenge, and we're going to get all the guns from Dad, and we're going to go to school, and we're just going to kill everybody. Now, to how many people in this universe, this planet Earth, does this make sense? Two people, correct? But they've created their own artificial world. This universe doesn't exist except in their own minds. So to them, it makes sense. To any rational thinking person, this is a horrific act of evil. But see, that's what Maimonides says, HaRashut Natuna. God stood back and said, look, I'm giving you license to kill. You know, kind of like James Bond, 007, right? We have a license to kill, or we have a license to create. This is part and parcel of the human condition. So let's get back to our story here, and this will preface the contradiction. Okay, so now the serpent, the wily serpent, is speaking to Eve in the absence of Adam. Now, Adam made a fatal mistake. He made the world's first chumrah. Anyone know what a chumrah is, right? Astringency? When we extend a law. So, for example, on Shabbat, if I don't want you writing with a pen, we say, this pen is off limits. We call it muktzah. Can't touch it, move it, because if you happen to be able to be picking up in your hand, you absently write on Shabbat. So to protect yourself from writing on Shabbat, by habit, we say the pen has no purpose, therefore it's muktzah. We don't touch it. So that's essentially what Adam did, because God says to Adam, from that tree of good and evil, don't eat. He said, don't eat. Did he say, don't touch? No, that was Adam's own invention. Adam thought, oh my gosh, you know, if you play with the fruit, oh my gosh, you might accidentally take a bite out of the... By the way, it wasn't an apple. Okay? Absolute bava misa. Was not an apple. Medrash goes through everything. Could have been grapes, which makes a lot of sense, because how much misery have come into this world through the products of grapes, you know, wine specifically. Could be grapes, it could be an etrog, could be wheat. It goes through a whole bunch of possibilities. Apple's not one of them. So exactly where the apple got its slanderous, maybe it should be a lawsuit here, I don't know. Retroactive lawsuit brought by the apple industry, because it definitely wasn't an apple. But whatever that... Statute of limitations. I love it, I love it. Just a little outside of the statute. So whatever, the apple industry up where I used to live in Milton, New York, was a big apple territory, so we'll forego the lawsuit. So it wasn't an apple. So they take the fruit, okay, so they eat the fruit, and he says, look, here. And Eve says, I can't go near that tree. He says, why not? Because Adam, my husband, told me, God says, don't eat it, don't touch. Really? So listen to what the serpent says. The serpent was the most cunning of all the wild beasts that God had made. The Medrash goes on and tells us that actually there was a internal Yetzirah that came into the serpent. It was an angel, however you want to understand this, who looked for the most willing accomplice to get Adam and Eve. And the snake was the most willing accomplice. And so he inhabited the body of the snake, speaks to Eve in the absence of Adam, and he says like this, come on. Did God really say that you may not eat from any of the trees of the garden? Put your finger there. Come on, Eve. Look, you're living in the most magical place. But, you know, you're like animals in a zoo. God doesn't want you thinking for himself. Do you know, Eve, and this is what he really said to her, that God himself already ate from that tree? That's how he became God. And he's jealous. He wants to be the only one in the universe who has the ability to really understand how things work in this world. And that's why he has made it off limits to you, simply. You can't have anything in this garden. It's all off limits to you. And what's her response? So the woman, Chava, replies to the serpent, no, you're wrong. We may eat from the fruit of the trees in the garden. Everything's okay. But of the fruit of the tree that is, oh my gosh, in the middle of the garden, betoch hagan, God said, do not eat it and do not even touch it, or else you will die. The serpent said to the woman, you will certainly not die. Now, why did I say, oh my gosh?
Because you changed
what's in the middle. What's in the middle, ladies and gentlemen?
Life.
What? It's true. She says, no, it's the tree that's betoch hagan, that's in the midst of the garden, in the middle. That's the one that's off, but there's only one tree that's in the middle of the garden. Look back at verse number 9. The narrative description of the garden is betoch hamachal ve'etz hachayim betoch hagan, in the middle of the... Now, you can make an argument, okay? Ready to the argument? Tell me if this holds sway. You can say, well, you know what? They're both betoch. They're both in the midst. There was a tree of life. There's a tree of good and evil. And the mitz means like an approximate area. It's not so definitive. Yeah, sounds like a reasonable argument, right? Only one problem. Even if you want to say it's not literally the middle, that's okay. It's the midst, that area. But there's only one tree specifically described by the Torah as being betoch. Betoch doesn't have to be a literal description of where it is. It's telling you there is a tree that is in the midst of the garden. There's only one tree. The tree of life, not the tree of good and evil. So the Eitz HaDaas wasn't in the middle of the garden. So what tree is she talking about? Well, she's clearly talking about the tree of knowledge, correct? But yet she's also talking about the tree of life. So there's one possibility. It's Marosh Hashiva of Yaakov Weinberg that said the following. There's only one tree in the garden. There was one tree that was both the Eitz HaDaas, the tree of knowledge, and potentially the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life. One tree. There's no other possibility here. So what does that mean for us? The machshava, the intent of the person eating from the fruit, made, in fact, the fruit into whatever you were eating. So if Adam and Eve had eaten from the fruit of the Eitz HaChaim, the tree of life, with the knowledge of life, Arichat Yamin, Eitz Chaim Hi, L'machazikim Bach, all the good things that come with the tree of life, it would have been great. It would have been forever. Adam and Eve never would have died. But because they ate it with nefarious intent, it in fact became the Eitz HaDaas for them. It became the tree of knowledge, good and bad. And they wanted the good and bad. They wanted license to kill. They wanted to become like their creator God. And therefore, in fact, there was only the one tree. Just, I thought it was something interesting. I heard from Rosh Hashiva. It has ramifications beyond the scope of tonight's little class that we're having, but just something for you to think about. I think it's interesting fodder. In the minutia, when you read carefully just the basic translation, you'll see things that perhaps are amazing. Okay? Any comments before we carry on? Now we're going to get a little bit more amazing in my opinion. Yes?
Didn't say, don't eat from the tree of life, right?
Correct. Correct. And that's why he says at the end, Carolyn, Carolyn's making a very good point. What does he say at the end? He says, you got to go. You have to go because you now might eat from the tree of life. And with your knowledge of good and evil, with the combination of forever, the world will be destroyed. Whereas once you have the responsibility of good and evil, then you get to deal with the Yetzer Hara, with your evil inclination. I can't give you eternity. It's gone. Eternity only comes with those who don't have the good and the evil, the reshut, the license to kill. Because it can't be. The world won't exist. Now, what's amazing about this is that it shows us something. It's a fundamental truth about Judaism. Duality. The double-edged sword. Now, I'm not using this term loosely because it's actually the guardian of the tree of life. Is the Cherev HaMitapechet. Remember, when he hides the garden, what does he put there to guard the garden from us going back and getting a bite of that fruit from the tree of life, of Chaim? You know what he puts there? The double-edged sword. Well, what is double-edged sword? You know what double-edged sword is? It can mean a lot of things in Judaism. We know Torah can be a double-edged sword. We say, Zot HaTorah Asher Sam Moshe, that Moses placed. The Talmud says, but for those who learn it correctly, it's a sam, it's an elixir of life and longevity. But what if a person takes it, uses the Torah, and abuses the Torah, manipulates it, then it becomes a sam mavet, it becomes an elixir of death, it becomes poisonous. So there's always that duality. So it makes a whole lot of sense then, that the ultimate duality should be the tree of life or the tree of good and evil. Because that's the whole nature of our own existence. We have this tug and pull always between the Jacob and Esau parts of our neshama, correct? We're always at war with ourselves. That's the duality. So it makes sense then that there would only be one tree, because the one tree is expressing the duality of Judaism. If you look carefully, there's a whole, I mean, everything is duality, correct? I mean, you look down through the scope from, as we go through the parashat, you'll see all these different parts where there's different personas. I mean, the ultimate duality is Jacob himself. He's a dual persona. He's Jacob, but he's also Israel, right? I mean, it's the most clear Pashup shot as you can hear, that he's both Jacob and he's Israel. And you notice, it's different than all the other people who had name changes. In other words, when Avram becomes Avraham, when Abraham becomes Abraham, it is actually forbidden to ever refer to him by his original name, unless you're learning the Parsha in context where he still was Avram. You may not call. For example, if I'm giving a class, you know, outside of the Parsha, and I refer to Abraham and I call him Abram, that's an Avera, a sin. But what about Jacob? Well, even the Torah, after he gets the name Israel from God, the Torah, you know, goes back and forth. Sometimes it calls him Israel, sometimes it calls him Jacob. So clearly there's a duality there. And that has a lot of very powerful meaning for us as Jews. Okay, let's go into number two. Now, the Vilna Gaon was one of the giants of European Jewry. He was famous, among other things, for understanding the idea of Shivim Panim LaTorah. Has anyone ever heard that expression, that there's 70 approaches to learning Torah? And every one of them is a valid approach. I want to share something a little out of the box with you tonight, because we're all in synagogue, or have been in synagogue, and we hear the Torah reader, and we hear what they call the Tameh HaMikra, right? The trop accents. So I want to share with you how using the trop accents alone can give us a whole world that we wouldn't otherwise have access to. And this is from the closing of Genesis, okay? Noah is born. So his father, Vayikra et Shema Noach Lemor, his father called him Noah, saying, Zeh, you can see it works much better in the Hebrew with a big bold print. This young man, Yenachamenu Mimasenu Utmitzvon Yadenu, he will give us rest, comfort, nechama from our work and from the toil of our hands. Min ha'adama, from the earth, from the ground, asher erara Hashem, which God has cursed. Now, when did God curse the ground? If you recall, in the aftermath of Adam and Eve eating from the tree, they were both punished. The punishment for man was that he would work, toil, and sweat. B'zeas ha'pecho, right? He would schwitz, and he would work the land, and work the land. Kotz v'dardar tatzmiach lach. You'll plant everything in the world. It's going to be thorns and thistles. You'll have no success in the farming world. Sorry, that's the curse of Adam. Now, generations pass, 10 generations, to go from Adam to Noah. On the birth of Noah, his father somehow has a neviut, a prophetic insight, Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration from God, that Noah is somehow going to change the world, and that he will give comfort to a world that has been cursed. So let's have a look at Rashi. And the Rashi is on number two, right under in English. This one will give us rest. Do you see the Rashi? So what does Rashi say there? Why will he give us rest? He, meaning Noah, will give us rest from the toil of our hands. So Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchak, explains very simple. Before Noah came, they did not have plowshares. And he prepared these tools for them. He developed farming instruments. He was an inventor. He was way ahead of his time, the Thomas Edison. And the land was producing thorns and thistles when they sowed wheat because of the curse of the first man, Adam. But in Noah's time, the curse subsided. This is the meaning of Yenachamenu, comfort. Now, Noah's name means menucha, comfort, nechama. Right? Now, why will they have menucha, which means rest? Why will it be comfort? We said that comfort doesn't mean what we think it means. We say it's a paradigm shift. So this is a paradigm shift of enormous proportions, right? Because remember, this is the invention of John Deere. Okay, this is big. This is big stuff, okay? There was nothing before this. They didn't know how to plant. They planted everything on the surface of the earth beforehand, before Adam and Eve. You know, and Eve, everything kind of just grew naturally in the garden. They didn't have to work the Garden of Eden. But then they're cast out of the garden, and they're, you know, they have their seeds and they plant. There's nothing to go under the topsoil, so everything dies in the winter. It's all killed off. They have nothing to eat. 10 generations are suffering. And then paradigm shift, nechama, the comfort is, because Noah is this inventor. I don't know did they have the Russell Crowe character who played Noah in the recent movie? Did they show him inventing? I didn't see the movie really. Did he invent anything? They show him as this great inventor wearing the hat and, you know, working in the lab or something? I'm not sure. But because you never know. Maybe the Hollywood people got it right. So he was a great inventor. And because he invented the plow and the farming instruments, mankind changed. Huge paradigm shift. We were successful in seeding and sowing and planting and then gaining from the ground. Aha. So now let's get back to the trop. Okay? So I've given you enough information to understand the trap. So let's look at the verse again, right above number two in English. Okay? I left the trop in. Normally I take the trop accents, the Tameh HaMikra, out, but here I specifically left them in, and I put that one, Zeh, very, very big. Okay? So, Vayikra et Shema Noach Lemar. Father, Lemech, father of Noah, calls him Noah. Why? Zeh, he says, this kid, this young man, Yinachamenu, he will give us rest. So it's future. He will give us rest because he's going to invent the farm instruments. Now look at that word zeh. There are not one, but two trop accents over a one-syllable word. Now, has anyone here ever lain? I'm just curious. Anyone ever lained the end of Bereshit? You have to lain the whole parsha to get to there. It is crazy because you have to somehow, on a one-syllable word, have a tlisha, which is the little, looks like a magnifying glass over the zion. And then on the left side of the zion, you have the little circular little quotation marks, which are called gershayim. So you have to read it. Ostensibly, you would read it like this. Watch. Aha! Thank you, Reb Mordechai. But in every chumash, he knows the stuff. In every chumash, they have a little asterisk next to the zeh, and it says, "Yatim, we pronounce the trop first, gershayim, and then tlisha." Just to make sure we understand each other, tlisha is the little magnifying glass. The gershayim are the little two circular little doohickeys. Okay? So we have a minhag, a custom, that although it's written first the little magnifying glass, tlisha, then the gershayim, the Baal Koreh actually reads it this way. Zeh. That's the correct way of reading it. That's hard. You can hear my voice. Usually when I used to do this shul at Poughkeepsie, everyone would stop. You know, all the talking in the back. Nobody talks, okay? But if they did talk, they would hear this bizarre. It's almost like the shalshalat, right? When you hear a shalshalat go up and down and up and down, everybody kind of stops and pays attention. Same thing here. I mean, it's a one-syllable word. It's really not fair. At least give us two syllables, okay? So why in the world do we have a custom not only to have two trop accents over a one-syllable word, zeh, this young man, Noah, but why is it customarily read out of order? Why do we reverse the trop? Ah, I'm glad you asked. The Vilna Gaon asked this question. Now, you want to hear the Vilna Gaon's explanation? It's amazing. You ready for this? Amazing. The word talisha, talush, anyone who studied the 39 forbidden malachot, the work types of work, creative work that on Shabbat, we know that talush min ha-mukhbar is one of them. You may not take from the soil or something that is attached, like a branch or an apple, and pluck it on Shabbat. It is taking out from front something. Talisha means to pluck out. The word gershayim is not a very nice word. It means to be driven away. It's used in divorce. If somebody is a divorcee, she is actually called by Torah standards a gerusha. Ligaresh means to push someone away. So the Vilna Gaon, in his brilliance, says the following. Noah is called Noah. Why? Because that one word zeh is teaching us everything I just taught you with two trop accents, inverted. Because what was the state of the world before Noah? Gershayim. Gershayim. Man was driven away from the soil. He planted and planted and planted to no effect. So the earth was megarish man. It abandoned him and drove him away. But then in the aftermath of the invention by Noah of the plow and the farming instruments, tilisha, man was able to pluck and cultivate and take from the earth the produce from the earth for the very first time. So when we take the two trop accents on Noah's name, we're actually telling us before Noah, what was the state of the world? Gershayim. Gershayim. You're driven away. You can't have access to the produce of the world. Nothing. Then, tlisha. Then you can reach down and take from the soil the fruit of the earth because of the plow. All from two little trop accents teaches us an entire amazing approach to Torah. So when we talk about Shivim Panim LaTorah, I know that was a little off, but I hope you appreciated that. Next time you hear a Torah reading, you're going to go, oh my gosh, if it's only on these two, it must be on everything. It is on everything else. And the Vilna Gaon has a whole lot to say about a whole lot of the others. That will be the end of our discussion tonight, but I hope that just whetted your appetite, that when you hear Trav, it's serious stuff. I mean, it gives us insights that are beyond our mildest imaginations. Okay?
That concept is in music all the time, when you'll take one syllable and then make two and three and four and five syllables.
And they evoke feeling, they evoke perhaps in a certain piece of music a certain thing that they wanted to, that the composer wanted to bring out, correct? Very good. And you're saying it beautifully, right? That, like, just as in music, when you watch a movie, what is the purpose of the score? To give us context into what we're watching, right? I'll give you an example. It's beautifully said, because when you watch, say, a movie without sounds, have you ever tried to watch, like, late at night and there's no volume? So it's a horror movie, right? Someone's tiptoeing up the stairs, you know? Doom, doom. So if you had the volume up, you'd hear a doom, doom, doom. Right? But every day, thousands of people around the world, you know, walk upstairs and open doors. But they don't have that type of fear, right? So you need the music to give the feeling of what, to contextualize what you're watching.
Or you can put in different music and completely change.
Exactly. But the greatest scores, Jason, tell me if I'm right or wrong, are the ones you really don't even hear. You feel them, right? If you hear that, sometimes you go to a movie and the score is so in your face that you're kind of overwhelmed to say, oh my gosh, I'm stepping back. It's just too much there. The really great composer, like John Williams, maybe the greatest composer of Hollywood movies, you know, his greatness is that you have to really hear it. You have to almost be in the business to pay attention, because it's so beautifully, seamlessly woven in to evoke the feelings of the romance on the beach or the stairs, you know, whatever the feeling is. So what Barry is saying beautifully is that the same thing with the Torah. The Torah is evoking with the trop, certain things that could not be there without the trop. So when you hear the Torah read on Shabbos with the trop, it just adds a whole different dimension to our appreciation of what Torah is actually telling us. And if you have the knowing ear, and if you're the Vilna Gaon, I guess, can you imagine being the Vilna Gaon in Shabbat? Oh my gosh, it must have been fun to be a Bal Kore. Imagine being the Torah reader in front of him, you know? You'd stop you in every nuance, you know, wait a minute, whoa, you know? Everyone else just, like, leaves off a trop, no big deal, right? To the Vilna Gaon, it was probably a very big deal in his shul. I would not want to be under the microscope of the Gra trying to read Torah for him. So thank you for mentioning that. Okay, the bottom of the page, number three. So, God speaks to Noah, and he says to him, not a good thing. This is now the beginning of Noah. We have transitioned from Genesis into the Parsha of Noah. The end of all flesh has come before me, God says, for the earth has become full of robbery, Hamas. Interesting that Hamas means robbery, isn't it? Does anyone ever think about it? I mean, every year when I hear that word Hamas, violence, robbery, I wonder who we're... What are you folks? What? All right. You think that's a coincidence that Hamas is coming? Okay. All right. So has become full of robbery or really violence because of them. And behold, I am destroying them from the earth.
Who is them?
The Hamas in the Gaza. You know, Hamas, the terrorists.
No, here. It says the earth has become full of robbery because of them.
Them meaning mankind. Mankind.
All flesh.
Mankind. And the animals also followed, we are told, the path of mankind. They learned from mankind to kill each other, rob, and do a lot of corrupt activities. Make for yourself an ark, a teva of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with compartments, and you shall caulk it both inside and outside with pitch. Please turn to the last page. So why is it that God gave Noah this 120-year ark to build? So Rashi tells us, make for yourself an ark. Why?
There's a lot of administrative hoops that they had.
This is true. Many ways to bring relief and rescue are available to him, Rashi asks. Right? Yeah, there's a lot of different ways he could have saved who he wanted to save from the generation, the Dor HaMabul, the generation of the flood. Why did he choose the ark? In other words, why is this the method? Why not just have, I don't know, Noah and the crew can go up to Mount Ararat or Mount Everest, wherever, have a little sanctuary up there, build a little, you know, little ear miklot, little city of refuge, and, you know, maybe Og the giant, yeah, you can come in, Og, nobody else. Why did it have to be this, right? Build some levees around him, protect him from the flood. I mean, God doesn't have to make it a big project where Noah works for 120 years, sweating. What's going on? Why then did God burden him with this construction? Huh? In order that the people of the generation of the flood of the Dor HaMabul should see Noah occupying himself with it, with the ark, for 120 years, they should ask him, "Hey, Noah, what do you need this?" Bill Cosby famously said, I don't know if you remember the famous Bill Cosby where they asked the neighbors, said, "Hey, Noah, what are you doing?" He wasn't allowed to say, you know, what the reason, if you recall. Remember, and he said, "Can't tell you guys." Remember, and they said, "Can you give us a hint?" Bill Cosby says, Noah told them, "Yeah, guys, how long can you tread water for?" So the people would see him building the ark, and they would ask him, "For what do you need this?" And he would say to them, "HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed is He, is destined to bring a marvel, a flood upon the world. Perhaps they would repent." So clearly then, the reason for the 120-year construction project given to Noah is God's hoping, against hope, that mankind, last chance, guys. Okay, last call. You want to hop aboard the ark train? Let's do a little teshuva, a little repentance here. Okay. Next, number four. Noah was 600 years old, and the flood came about. Water upon the earth. And Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him into the ark because of the flood waters. Now, following question. Was Noah successful? Did God's vision of 120-year opportunity, a window for mankind to repent, was it successful? How many people repented?
Zero.
Thank you, Jason. You're absolutely right. Zero. So let's pretend that he was in outreach, right? Kiruv. He was trying to reach out and bring people back to God. He would have been, Noah, the most dismal failure in the history of outreach. Not one individual in 120 years was not able to reach and change and effect meaningful change in their life and bring them aboard, right? Because there was space for them, ostensibly.
People knew the flood was coming.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were warned. The whole purpose is, and in fact, there's other Rashis that God had to protect Noah because the other people said, "Look, the water starts, we'll kill you. You're never going to get into that ark. You know, it's not going to happen." Right, there were the Bnei Elohim, you know, these giants, and there are a lot of bad guys around. There was some of Cain's descendants, you know, Cain's descendants, Tubal Cain, a lot of his progeny were lurking around in the shadows, you know, ready to kill Noah. So they threatened him, they're threatening his life, but they didn't come and say, "Repent." Even when the waters start to come, nobody's coming saying, "Chatati, Pashati," right? They may be trying to kill Noah and a family for revenge. But there's no successful kiruv. There's no successful outreach going on. No one's coming back to God. Zero. So God is hoping, as we said in the earlier Rashi, top of the page, that the whole specific purpose of making a public presentation of the project is to try to effect change of people. Nobody comes. Well, why not? I think Rashi answers it with the last number five. And here's the answer. Because of the floodwaters, let me read to you in the Hebrew. It says, "Mipnei meha mabul." Now, let's go back to verse that we said. This is verse right above in the middle of the page. It says that Noah was 600 years old and the flood came about, water upon the earth, right? And it says, and Noah went in, meaning to the ark, his sons' wives with him, into the ark. And look at the last three words of that verse. "Mipnei meha mabul." They went in because of the flood waters. Now, you could read that verse two different ways. They went into the ark because it was getting wet out, or the only reason they went into the ark at that point was because it started to rain. And that's what Rashi says. Listen to Rashi. It's a staggering Rashi. I'll read you in the Hebrew. "Mipnei meha mabul." You can follow the translation number five below. They went in because of the floodwaters. Af Noah, even Noah, as great as he was, miketanei emunahaya, he was of little faith. He didn't really believe. Ma'amin, yeah, he believed. Ve'ena ma'amin, but he didn't really believe it. She'yavo amabu, he didn't really believe the flood was going to come. Yeah, I'll build. I'm 20 years, God, thank you, great. He didn't really believe it. Ve'lo nichnas la'teva, he didn't actually enter into the ark. Ad she'dechuku ha'mayim, till he was forced there by the water coming up, but he had no choice. Enter the ark or you will die. Now this is a staggering Rashi. And it explains why he had the worst outreach organization in history. It's very simple. He didn't walk the walk. When you are trying to effect hashpa, influence on somebody to do something. If you don't believe it, if you're not passionate, and if it's not coming from the fiber of your existence in your heart, people pick up on this. You can't fool people. You can preach and pretend. So Noah did a lot of preaching. Repent, right? But he himself, somewhere in the recesses of his mind and his heart, he didn't really believe it.
And he tried last second to get other people.
Right.
But it says very clearly that he got nobody. But look what Rashi says.
But at the last, because the water was coming up, maybe he felt that people would follow him at that point.
Okay, but I'm not disagreeing, but according to this Rashi, no, you're right, Bruce, it's very good. But according to this Rashi, he's saying, Mikitane emunah haya. He was of little faith himself. I hear what you're saying. It could be at the end, from God's perspective, let's open it up, maybe people will come. But the bottom line was that if you're trying to influence someone else, to bring someone closer to God, if you don't walk the walk, sinish garnish elephant, right? It's not going to work.
But he continued to build and complete the art.
He did the project.
He did.
Exactly. But everything he didn't do it with the passion of an Abraham. That's the whole difference. You see, Abraham and Sarah had the most successful outreach program in history. And it wasn't just because Sarah made a great shalom. And it wasn't just because Abraham was a great schmoozer, okay? He believed it. He used to blow people's idolatry right off the window. People would come, and they had the magical little tree, the Tolkien-type tree, coming over them. And the tree would tell them, does this guy need a lot of work, a little bit of work, or no work? What's the status of the evil in this man's soul? He's like the shadow, right? Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men, right? Only the shadow. So Abraham was told by this tree how much work this guy needs, but Abraham walked the walk. Abraham literally goes into a fiery furnace for God, right? It's not a joke for him. Noah wouldn't have gone into that furnace. And next week we'll talk more about the contrast between Noah and Abraham. But clearly, the reason Abraham was successful in his movement is because people understood he's the real deal. And I think it's a very powerful thing for us, a message to both empower us and maybe scare us a little bit. That if you do something because it's rote, it's laudable. Noah is a wonderful person. And we'll debate the merits and demerits of the greatness of Noah at another day. He's a phenomenal human being. To be alone in a world with no role models, nobody to, except I guess maybe his Zadie, Mrs. Shelach was around to help him. Methuselah was a great man, right? Lived 969 years, so he was around, up until the flood. So Methuselah was around, and I guess he was a great person. So he had, a little bit of support. But he's essentially alone in a world full of Hamas, right? Not a good place to live, and if you're not living in near Gaza, it's a horrible place to live. And yet he still was a wonderful human being. So that's the whole idea of the Rashi. Is it relative to the generation that he's wonderful, or is it a statement that would surpass all generations? It's another story. But just to take away, I think it's very simple. If we want to affect ourselves, and if we want to affect others, the only thing that we have to keep in mind is that we have to begin with ourselves. That if we walk the walk, if we believe it, if we're passionate about something, others will sense that passion. And I just will finish with just a statement. I think you see it in anything you do in life. When you go to a class, or you go to a presentation, it could be about an arcane subject that you ostensibly have no interest in. But if a person is just passionate and presents the material and they themselves just love this, you enjoy the class. You say, oh my gosh, I never really thought I'd be interested in Custer's Last Stand. I heard my father-in-law wax for about 2 hours, wax eloquent about it, and he's such knowledge and minutia about Custer. He just brought me into the world of Custer, and I was like, with trepidation, waiting for the final denouement. I knew what was going to happen. But the way he placed, all the things that went wrong the day of Custer, and how, all the minutia, I never really looked at it. But he made it come alive to the point where it was like a movie. It was so exciting. So I think in our real lives, if we can take that, our passion, and bring it to others, that's the way to really successfully bring others tachas kanfei Hashchina, if you will, under the protective divine wings of our Creator. Shabbat shalom.